Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
We're breaking with format slightly this time because our guest is not here to talk primarily about meditation. Her name is Gretchen Rubin. You may know her from her mega best-selling book, The Happiness Project. After that, she wrote a book called Better Than Before. A couple of things about Gretchen. One, she's just awesome and has been so helpful to me, almost irrationally so. Way before my book came out, she gave me all this advice and was just really, 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 really helpful. And she then, when I was starting this podcast, I basically imitate her. She wrote a book, I wrote a book, then she started a podcast, so I started a podcast. And when I was trying to figure out how the hell to do this thing, she actually came on as our first guest, which actually you can go back and listen to if you scroll through the feed on the podcast. And at the time, what we talked about was her then current book called Better Than Before, which was all about how we make and break habits, which is just so central to our happiness and our health. And one of the things that she came up with in that book was this framework that she called the four tendencies that kind of breaks down how different people respond to expectations, inner expectations and outer expectations. Obviously, that's a huge component of how we make or break habits. So why this is relevant and germane when it comes to meditation is because that is a habit that a lot of people struggle to establish. In fact, I'm writing a whole book about how to overcome the major obstacles to establishing a meditation habit, which comes out at New Year's, by the way. But anyway, we're here to talk about Gretchen because she's got a new book now that's dedicated entirely to these four tendencies, and they're fascinating to be able to hear sort of where do you fit within these tendencies and how can you use this understanding of your own sort of tendencies when it comes to expectations so that you can set up a framework that allows you to do the things you need to do to take care of yourself. Really fascinating stuff. And she's, as you're going to hear, just a lot of fun. So here she is, Gretchen Rubin. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Well, congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thank you.
It's sort of cool to have you back here since you were the first ever guest.
I know. I feel very special. I was like the inaugural guest appearance.
Experimental.
Yes.
Very patient. Doing it in my living room with cats, and you don't even like cats.
Well, I'm allergic to cats. I like them. Cats sense if you're allergic, and they come bounding towards you and rub up against you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, no, but it was fun.
I can't remember. Did we make you take Claritin or something like that?
No, I meant that bad. If I don't pet them, I'm okay.
Gotcha, yeah. Gotcha. Or if you just avert your gaze.
Yes. But that was fun.
It was fun. So the four tendencies,
yeah.
The new book,
yes.
Give me the lowdown. I have to say, because I've been so tied up in writing my next book,
yes.
I've read only parts of this new book. I really like it, and I really like there's something about the writing in this one that I just really enjoy. I've always enjoyed your writing, but this one, there's a real confidence, there's a real kind of light spirit to it, even though you're talking about big ideas.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear, because I really did work hard to make it like fun and accessible, mm-hmm. because I'm really just laying out a framework, and that can get pretty dry and abstract. So I really tried to pump it up with like lots of examples from real life, or you know, funny anecdotes about how it had come up in my own life, and try to make it more lively so that people could really imagine these four tendencies out in the world, not just sort of, you know, I started my career as a lawyer, and I always have to beware of when that lawyerly training comes creeping back into my writing. I have to fight it off.
Well, I think you did so successfully on this one. The just by way of background, this yeah. emerged from your last book, Better Than Before, and which was about habit formation. Am I saying that correctly, all that?
Yeah, absolutely right. So in Better Than Before, I identified the 21 strategies that we can use to make or break our habits. And as I was identifying the 21 strategies, I was very struck by certain patterns that I saw, which was like some strategies seemed to work really well for some people, but then really didn't work for other people. Well, why or why not? Or why were certain people facing certain kinds of frustrations? Like there was a big group of people who would say something like, well, I can always make time for other people, but I can't make time for myself. And that's why I can't keep my habit. And I was like, that's interesting because I don't feel that problem. That's not a frustration that I face. So what do all these people have in common? Or just hearing how people approached it, I really started to sense these big patterns. And that's what turned into the four tendencies. But once my book Better Than Before came out, it was deluged with people who wanted to know really like sophisticated, advanced questions about the four tendencies. I'm a doctor. I want to use it with my patients, or I'm, you know, trying to use it in couples counseling, or
and
asking me for more information. And so I really just decided I needed to think it through, all the different aspects of the tendencies, and write a whole book that would be sort of the guide to how to think about them.
We're going to walk through the tendencies systematically, but is your vision that this will be something that will be adopted in a kind of a grand scale in doctors' offices, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that's my hope, of course. Because I really do feel like one of the things that's striking about the four tendencies is once I say this framework, it's not subtle. It's really obvious. You will see it around you everywhere. You'll see it in yourself and other people. And it really does offer you clues about how to work with other people more effectively. And so, like, there's starting to be research done in the healthcare field to try to validate this or to see how it works in practice. Different people are using it in different ways to see if they can change the way they set up certain programs in order to increase people's adherence to medication or how much they'll stick to a program. And so, yeah, I mean, if nothing but to help people take their medication, that would save billions of dollars and thousands of lives. So, you know, I hope that people do find it useful.
You make a kind of and I apologize if I'm misremembering that, this, but because it's been a few weeks since I looked at your book when I was out at the beach on vacation. You make a kind of audacious claim that you feel like almost that you stumbled upon a law of nature.
It feels that way. It does feel that way. Or maybe it's a muggle sorting hat. I don't know, you know, dividing people into four houses. But it really feels like when I finally came up, when I saw the pattern and how it fits together, it has sort of the elegance of nature. Everything is included. Nothing's left out. Nothing's left hanging. It accounts for a lot. It's a very narrow framework, but it seems to really be durable. You know, the more because I think about it constantly, like, well, what about this and what about that? And somebody could argue this. And it feels like it's holding up to that.
That's exciting.
It is exciting. It is exciting.
So let's walk through it, because I think this is the good stuff. Because
people
are going to hear these
things.
What are
you?
And they want to know where do you fit in the tendency. So you usually start with upholder, because you are an upholder.
I am an upholder. Yes. Okay. So the four tendencies are upholder, questioner, obliger, and rebel. And it has to do with how you respond to expectations, which sounds very dry, but ends up being very, very juicy to think about. So we all face outer expectations, like a work deadline or a request from a friend. And then we all face inner expectations, which is our own desire to start meditating, our own desire to keep a New Year's resolution. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline, they keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. Then questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if it meets their inner standards. So they meet inner expectations. If they feel like something's arbitrary or unjustified or irrational, they won't do it. They will reject it. So if something meets their standard, they will meet that expectation. If they reject it as unjustified, they won't. Then obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So I got my glimpse into this when a friend said to me, because I am kind of this happiness bully that's always asking people how they could be happier. My friend was like, well, I know I would be happier if I went running. And when I was in high school, I was on the track team and I never missed track practice. So why can't I go running now? Well, why not? I would say, now having figured this out, she's an obliger. When she had a team and a coach waiting for her, expecting her, she had no trouble showing up. But when she's just trying to go on her own, she struggles. And then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectation, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. And if you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. Typically, they don't even want to tell themselves what to do. Like, typically, they wouldn't sign up for a 10 a.m. Woodworking class because they're like, I don't know what I'm going to want to do on Saturday. I don't know what I'm going to want to do in the morning. I don't want to, like, why would I want to clog up my calendar? You know, I just want to feel free and do what I feel like doing.
And rebels, and we'll get into this, they often get frustrated at themselves. Well, everybody gets frustrated.
A lot of us get frustrated with ourselves in different ways. I think it's a particular issue for Rebels because a lot of things that work for the other tendencies don't work for Rebels. So if you know you're a Rebel, you know someone else is a Rebel, it's kind of points you in a direction that might be very different from something that you would try with somebody from the other tendencies. Their perspective is quite different.
So let's go through these from the beginning. Upholder. What are the characteristics of an upholder? How does habit formation or breaking bad habits work in your life? Is it all easy for you if you're an upholder?
Well, you know, it's funny. It is easier. It is easier for me. And I remember, Dan, you have been trying to lead me to the path of meditation for a long time. You're the one of the people that got me to really try it. And I said to you, I was meditating and I got nothing out of it. And it was actually hard for me to stop meditating because it's like once I'd started the habit, I couldn't stop. And you were like, that's funny because that's not usually the problem. People don't usually find it easy to form the habit of meditation, but then not.
You're literally the only person I've ever heard this from.
Right. So I know one day we will try again, you and I.
No. There's only one bully in this room.
Yes, I know.
By the way,
you're the lightest touch of anybody, which is probably why I was willing to try it again.
I have a light touch, but I want to just say in defense of you and your bullying, actually, it's really fun.
Okay.
And actually, one of the things I want to do at the end of this is let you bully me on a number of scores. So.
Oh, good. Okay, well, I look forward to that. So, for upholders, it's easier to form habits. It's easier to meet expectations. And like with the Happiness Project, people would say to me, oh, well, how did you get yourself to do all that stuff that made you happier? And I said, well, I knew it would make me happier, so I just decided to do it. And they would say, like, but how did you get yourself to do it? And I was like, I don't really understand what your issue is. Now I understand that I'm an upholder. And by the way, upholder is a very small tendency. Rebel is the smallest tendency. Upholder is only slightly larger. These are extreme personality types, pretty rare. The biggest one is obliger. You either are an obliger or you have many obligers in your life, a lot of obligers, and also lots of questioners. So most people are questioners or obligers. So one of the things I learned about an upholder is like things do come more easily for me, like in habit formation, than they do for other people. Upholders tend to be sort of self-starters. They don't need a lot of supervision. They don't usually need a lot of accountability, but they can also seem judgmental because they don't understand why other people are struggling with things that are coming easy to them. They can seem rigid because they really want to stick to they want to meet outer and inner expectations. And so they can sometimes my sister made fun of me because I was visiting her in Los Angeles and I stayed on East Coast time. So I just went to bed every night at 7. And she's like, you're kind of a killjoy. And I was like, well, yeah, but for me, it made sense and was, made perfect sense. She did not think, she thought that was ludicrous. But
I think it's ludicrous, too, just for the record.
Okay. But I was like, but why would I like kind of make myself sick staying up late for like 3 nights and just when I'm back on West Coast time, then I have to go back to the East Coast.
I know.
You know, I had all these. It's just people have different perspectives.
Yes.
It's not that one of us is right and one of us is wrong, but it's just like we have different views. So that's very upholder. Anyway, there is sort of a...
That's such a crazy story. I actually, I see the logic.
Okay.
I see the logic.
Your listeners to write you and say, are they on Team Dan Elizabeth or Team Gretchen?
I'm sure.
It was 3 nights.
I'm sure I have lots of crazy listeners who will be on your team. I get it. Your logic actually is solid, but it's still a bit of a unusual thing to
do. Okay. See, this is the thing. Like, to me, it seemed perfectly logical. And it was just like, you're crazy. But yeah, okay. So that's upholder. There you go with from upholder. Because they do seem sort of like extreme like that to other people. And then, then questioners.
Hold on 1 second. Let me just stay on upholder for a second.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
I think I may be an upholder.
Do you think so?
Maybe. Because I've been able to, just based on my own inner expectations, do some crazy habit formation stuff. Like I meditate 2 hours a day. I decided 2 years ago I was going to do that.
Yeah.
And I do it. I exercise 6 days a week. And actually recently I was at a birthday party for a guy you may have heard of named Strauss Zelnick. He's a 60-year-old guy. He's super successful and incredibly fit. And he's actually has a book coming out next year about how to stay fit into your later 60s. Years.
Yeah.
And I was just really inspired by how fit he is and how happy he is and how great, how close his friends were at age 60. And I, just told myself, all right, I'm going to up my game. I need to do more exercise. Not crazy amounts, but just like instead of just doing 30 minutes of cardio, I need to really get back to going to a spin class or running the Central Park Loop or working with my trainer in a harder way. And I've just done it. However, However,
yeah.
I know, and you and I have discussed this before right here on this show, that I know I need to quit sugar.
Right.
And I've done it off and on. And in fact, I'm off sugar right now, but haven't been able to make that stick. So I don't know.
Food is a little tricky. I feel like you can't sort of always judge by food, because that's like there's a lot of things going on with eating habits that are complicated. Well, do you feel like when you're changing that habit, is it because you're like, I understand now why I would do that? Like, I've been convinced by the reasoning of it and why this is the efficient way to do it? Or is it more like, this is just what I want to do for myself?
You know, it may be that I'm a questioner in that sense. Because, for example, with sugar, I've quit many times. About 8 days ago, I texted my wife after a night where we had had a bunch of sugar and I was feeling awful.
Yeah.
And I said, when am I going to admit that I'm poisoning myself? And she said, you just did. Let's quit together. And actually, the fact that we're doing it together, I actually have some hope that this will be able to stick. And I always talk about you. I say that you, as Gretchen says, that you just decided one day, I'm a person who doesn't eat sugar.
Yeah.
You can make me a birthday cake, but I won't eat it.
Yeah.
That has had such a powerful resonance for me. And I know that I'm so addictive. To me, you said this thing about how when you stopped eating sugar, it ended this conversation that
the
was
noise.
So boring.
Yes.
Right? And I'm having that conversation all the time. Like, well, maybe I'll have it after dinner tonight.
Yes.
But then what am I going to feel
yes.
like tomorrow?
Oh,
yes.
It's so boring.
Boring.
Oh, it's tiring.
It's really tiring.
And it's sort of the half self-control, like, ugh.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Or like my favorite thing.
Some people can do moderation.
Oh, no. Yes, absolutely. And I talked about that in Better Than Before. Some people can do moderation. But like my favorite example was I sat in a meeting for 2.5 hours with a plate of cookies in the middle, and I didn't eat it. A cookie the whole time, and then on my way out the door, I ate 3 cookies because it's like it finally just the clock had run out, you know. And I the whole time it had just been draining my self control, you know. Now it's just like, oh, you can put these freshly baked Toll House cookies are right next to me, and I just want to eat them. So,
and I think where I'm at now with if somebody put freshly baked cookies in front of me, I'd be feeling a lot of because I have a pronounced addictive tendency. Feeling a lot, but. I think now I'm starting to see that if I ate them, I would be so miserable.
Yes.
And
yes.
I just had to have my face shoved into the poop so many times, like a dog, you know, who poops on the rug and has to be taught over and over and over again. And I wonder whether maybe I'm now at the point where, like, okay, I get it now.
But see, this is a great example, even like taking your specific example out of it, of like why knowing your tendency can be helpful to you if you're trying to make a change. Because let's say you're trying to quit sugar. If you know that you're a questioner, I would say go deep into knowledge, read all the books, get the information, really get clarity on why this is what you want. This is the thing that's going to work for you. This is why it's justified. This is the research that's going to back it up. This is why it's going to be customized for you. You're going to tweak it so it's just right for you. This is you really understand why you're doing something. If you're an obliger, I would say go deep into outer accountability. That's what works for obligers. Think about, let's do it together. Think about your need to create a sugar-free environment for your son. Think about, I need to set a good example for the people who work for me. Think about, I need to be healthy into my older years. And if I quit now, I know that, you know, as a 60, 70, 80-year-old, I'm going to have much better health. And so the people who rely on me are going to have me for the long term. There's a million ways to build in outer accountability. That's what obligers need. Rebel, what do you want? What do you choose? You want to be free. What kind of person do you want to be? So then I would say things to yourself like, I'm not addicted to sugar. They can't fool me with their big marketing campaigns and their crinkly packages. They can't addict me with their chemicals and their bad sugar. I'm free. I can do whatever I want, and I choose to be a healthy, energetic person. These are different. Like, they're all right. These are all way approaches. But when you know your tendency, you can kind of go deep into the values of your tendency, and you can sort of push the buttons that are going to be probably most likely to resonate with you. And if you're trying to help someone else, if I'm your doctor and you're saying to me, doctor, I really want to do this. If I knew your tendency, then I could start talking to you in the way that would probably be the most likely. If you're a rebel, I shouldn't tell you to join an accountability group. If you're an obliger, I shouldn't hand you a giant stack of studies. You know, and if you're an upholder, I should just be like, hey, let's just sit down and talk about why the time is right for you to do this. And you'd be like, okay.
This is why I think I'm probably an upholder with shades of questioner and obliger in there, which is what I like about your tendencies, actually, because they start to have overlaps in the Venn diagram.
There is a quiz at happiercast.com/quiz. You can take a quiz.
Say the URL
again. It's happiercast.com /quiz. I'm coming up on like a million people having taken this quiz. And it's in the book, too. Yeah. It's in the Four Tendencies. How do you feel about New Year's resolutions?
I think they're arbitrary and stupid.
Okay, that's questioner right there. Bing, 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 bing. Yeah. That's a questioner answer. I think you're a questioner.
Okay.
You're a questioner who has like just the minute when you see that something makes sense for you, you're able to execute. And that's very questioner.
Okay. All right. I buy that.
Yeah.
I buy that. It makes sense.
Whenever somebody says the word arbitrary, that's like, you know, all the bells go off. Yeah.
Okay. So is that the next bucket we're diving into?
Yeah. Or questioner.
Okay.
So the value of questioners is that questioners are very focused on reasons and justifications. So like if you have a questioner in your life or at work or something, they're the ones that are like, why are we doing this? Is this a big waste of time? Is there a better way to do this? Why are, you know, the fact that we've always done something a certain way or because you're telling me to do it isn't convincing. And so they really keep everybody on track to spend their time, their energy, their money most efficiently because they're the ones that are going to protest. On the other hand, questioners sometimes drain and overwhelm other people with their questions. You know, they ask a lot of questions and others may be like, we've talked about this so long, we don't need to talk about it anymore. You're a drag. Sometimes they can seem like insubordinate or not team players. Or like if you're a questioner child questioning a teacher, you could seem disrespectful. If you're saying like, well, why should I memorize the multiplication tables? I can just look on my phone or on a calculator and look it up. Like this makes no sense. And the teacher's like, because I say so, because all fourth graders have to learn their multiplication tables. Well, that questioner child is like not convinced by that. They need a robust explanation. They could sometimes have analysis paralysis, which is when they want perfect information before they make a decision. And so they just stall out because they're getting more and more and more information. That can also drain them and drain the people around them. I mean, I'm married to a questioner, so I'm very aware of the pros and cons of being around questioners. And they're great because they're like, why would we do this? It doesn't make sense. So they save you a lot of time and effort. But it can be tiring to be around somebody who's just like my husband, like will not do something if he doesn't know why. And like, I'm just like, just do it because I tell you to. It's like, no, he needs to know why. So fair enough. I've learned. But one of the good things about knowing the tendencies is like, he's like this all the time. It's not about me and our relationship. He's like this with everybody. And there's a lot of people who are just like him. So I don't have to feel, I can feel like it's a drag, but I don't have to take it personally.
Right.
Because it's just his nature.
Actually, there's something quite Buddhist in that, actually, that we have, that to learn to take stuff about ourselves and others less personally.
Yes. No, I think the Four Tendencies really helps with that because you're like, it's not a reflection on the way you think about me. It's just the way you approach the world.
Right.
And that's fine. And a lot of times it's not that there's a right way and a wrong way. It's just that people are coming from different places.
But I think you're probably right that I'm a questioner, but I do have a tendency on some levels to actually kind of just go along sometimes. So I don't know how that fits.
Well, maybe because it's more efficient to do that.
Maybe it tends to be when I'm overloaded or when I'm just don't feel like thinking hard about something. I'll rush and just say yes to something.
Well,
or
this is the thing that a lot of questioners complain about. It's exhausting to be a questioner. It's really tiring. And in fact, I've talked to people who like will have questioner, like they're a questioner. They want a questioner partner in a business or they're married to a questioner because they're like, it's so much work to be a questioner. But if I'm partnered with a questioner, I can trust that they will have the same thoroughness. And so I can trust their decisions because most people I feel like don't really make reasoned judgments. I often hear this from questioners. They're like, why are other people like lemmings? They just go along with everything. They never ask questions. It's tiring to be a questioner.
So that's interesting. So I've partnered with this guy, Ben Rubin, no relation to you, CEO of the 10% Happier Company. He questions a lot, and I find it deeply comforting to know I've outsourced a lot of my analysis to this guy.
Yes.
Let him worry about it.
Yes, and that's one of the ways that that questioners can manage analysis paralysis or question overwhelm. It's either by setting deadlines, like I'm going to make a decision by Friday. Like at some point, any decision is better than no decision, so I'm going to decide by Friday. By setting limits, I'm going to investigate 10 accounting software programs, but not 30 software programs, or a trusted authority. This is a person who I trust. I trust their judgment and their expertise. If something's good enough for them, I can be very guided by their judgment. And so but he's a questioner. So you know that he's not going to just wave his hand to things without understanding the reasons why. So that's a great way for you to alleviate your kind of cognitive load by delegating to him a lot of research and decision making.
Yes.
That you would
yes.
otherwise have to do yourself.
I hope I'm categorizing him correctly in terms of the tendencies, but at the very least we can say he's really smart.
Yeah.
And I don't have to worry that he's going to make a dumb decision, and actually then I don't have to worry about doing the deciding myself.
Well, having met him, it rings true to me that he's a questioner.
Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of has that.
But what? So one of the things that's really interesting, I mentioned this before, is that you set up the four tendencies as kind of overlapping
yeah.
Venn diagrams. That you know you can be a questioner with
who tips
in one way.
Yes, because questioners in some ways are like upholders, because questioners and upholders both readily meet inner expectations. But questioners also overlap with rebels, because questioners and rebels both resist outer expectations. So you can have, like, my husband is an upholder who tips, is a questioner who tips to upholders. So he, it's pretty easy to convince him to go along with things. Like, it's easy for him to see why you would do things. Some questioners are, they're very, very hard to convince. They really, really, really resist anything that to them seems arbitrary or unjustified. So, for instance, they might not drive 65 miles an hour because they're like, that's an arbitrary limit. Like, I'm a really good driver. I should be able to drive as fast as I can. And you're like, well, it doesn't work like that. Or like, why five garments in a dressing room? That makes no sense. I'm going to take in 10. You know, or somebody who wrote it, she's like, I go into that the playground near my house has a sign saying that you're not supposed to go in if you're not accompanied by a minor. But I do it all the time because I'm not going to do anything to hurt anybody. And I was like, well, do you think everybody should be able to live their life that way? And she was like, well, maybe not, now that you mention it. And I was just like, because she was a questioner who tipped to rebel.
So what I like about this is there's a range.
There is a range.
I'm a questioner, but I would follow those rules.
Yes.
So I'm probably a questioner who tips upholder.
I think you are.
Because part of me does just, I'm a bit on some levels, I can be kind of, in some contexts, a bit of a rule follower.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the other thing about this, is that there's variability, and the variability can depend in part on context.
Well, it's
like you're different with your parents and their rules than you might be with teachers and their rules. I mean, I just took my kid yesterday for his first meeting at his school, and they were telling us that many kids are much better behaved at school than they are at home.
Right, right. Well, that probably has to do with anxiety, I think. And that's one of the things that's really important to understand about the tendencies. Is this is something that only describes a very narrow aspect of your nature, which is how do you respond to expectations? So you're a questioner, and we could line up 50 questioners. And depending on how ambitious they were, how considerate of other people's feelings they were, how intellectual they were, how curious they were, how adventurous they were, how extroverted or introverted they were, how neurotic they were, all these things could mix up in all different ways. And so you'd look very different from each other. But as to, I'm going to ask you to do something, you're going to say to me, why should I? That's what the questioner says. Why should I? You're all going to respond that way to an expectation. But like a really smart questioner is different from a pretty ignorant questioner.
Right. Gotcha.
You know, very intellectual questioner. And same thing like a rebel. Sometimes people are like, oh, rebels are selfish. Not necessarily. Some rebels are incredibly considerate of other people, have very high ideals, high ambitions for themselves. But then there are some rebels who don't really care what other people think of them. That's going to look, being a rebel is going to look very different depending on how it's mixed up with these other characteristics.
But are you going to say that there's no overlap between a questioner and an obliger?
Right, because they're sort of the opposite of each other. But, just as rebels and upholders are opposite.
But I do feel like I do better sometimes with accountability. Like when I wanted to quit sugar, now I want to quit sugar, it's so important to me that my wife's in it with me. Like, I'd probably go vegan if my wife was in it, you know, if she wanted to do it.
But is that partly just because of the way your life is set up?
Yeah. No, it's all about that.
Right. But what if your wife set up your life so that you were quitting sugar, but you knew that when she went to work, she was eating sugar? Would that matter to you?
I wouldn't care, no.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's just you're trying to create a situation that is going to support you.
I guess on the margins, I do. It would be fun for us to really be in it together.
Well, that'd make it more fun.
Yeah.
I get that. Yeah.
And I think it might make it stickier, the habit or the lack of habit, whatever.
Well, now we're getting back into like my kind of stuff I talked about in Better Than Before. And one of the things is the influence of other people, which no matter what your tendency, you're very affected by what the people around you are doing. Also, things like convenience or an inconvenience. It's more convenient to eat no sugar if no one's bringing sugar into your household and no one's ordering dessert when you go to a restaurant and nobody's saying like, hey, let's stop up at this cute little cafe and get a croissant because you guys don't eat that stuff. It's just easier.
Right. So you're not saying that makes me an obliger. You're saying that doesn't necessarily make me an obliger. Right. It's just kind of a different, right. It's a different, this is very narrow. This is how do you respond to expectations?
So, so like if you answer yes to the question, promises to other people can be broken. Promises to other people cannot be broken. Promises to myself can be broken. See, as an upholder, I don't agree with that. Promises to myself are just as important as promises to other people.
Yeah, I would. I mean, in theory, I would say I could break both. Under the right circumstances, I would break a promise to somebody else.
So here's another thing about questioners.
Under the right circumstances.
This is making me thinking you're a questioner because questioners don't see themselves in the other three tendencies see how they're different from other ones. And the questioners see themselves in the other tendencies more. So they feel like they're more of a mix. Like I was talking to a high school student and he was like, well, sometimes I'm a holder and sometimes I'm a rebel. And I said, well, give me an example. And he says, when I have a teacher I respect who gives me an assignment, I do it right away, like an upholder. But when a teacher I don't respect gives me an assignment, I refuse. So I'm a rebel. And I'm like, no, you're a questioner because your first question is, why would I listen to you? And so seeing yourself in all of the tendencies is kind of a questioner thing because they're like, well, under certain circumstances, you know, it's very questioner to be like, oh, I can think of this exception. Or, you know, what about this? Whereas like if you're an upholder, you get it. You're like, oh, yeah. What is the deal with other people?
So for the last
and obligers are like, oh my gosh, now I understand why I could only go to my exercise class when I went with my friend to that place where the teacher was like so hardcore if we didn't show up. And you're like, yes, it's the accountability. Or the rebel who's like, ah, now I understand why I can't use to-do lists. You know, yes.
You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected after investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns. T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile, third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. The weather's getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high-quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home and I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable. And the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier.
So for the last 20 minutes, everything I've said has basically just confirmed your thesis.
I think so. I think so.
Fair enough. I'm happy to do that. So let's go to obliger.
Okay. So obliger is the largest tendency. So it's important for everybody to think about obligers because you either are one or you've got a lot in your life. They're the rock of the world. They're type O, meaning that they partner up the best with all the other tendencies. They're great at meeting outer expectations, but they often get frustrated with themselves because they're not meeting their inner expectations. Now, the solution, the answer for this is so simple, and it is an obliger must create systems of outer accountability in order to meet an inner expectation. So if you want to exercise, you would sign up for a class, you would go with a friend who's annoyed if you don't show up, you're going to work out with a trainer, you're going to join an accountability group, you're going to focus on if you don't go running, your dog doesn't get his daily run and he's going to be so disappointed, you're going to think about, oh, I'm going to raise money for this by doing this 5K, so this charity that's really important to me is going to make more money. I'm going to model good behavior for the people in my household. These are for, I'm going to think about my future self. Oh, well, Dan right now doesn't want to go, but future Dan is going to feel bad if he doesn't exercise. So I owe it to future Dan. There's a million ways to build in outer accountability, but that is what is necessary. And obligers sometimes don't want that. They're like, I want to develop, you know, inner motivation. And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't really work. Don't bother with that. That's really hard.
It's just, not you.
Yeah, just, you know, and it's a huge tendency. So just build in these forms of outer accountability. If you want to read more, join a book group. You know, it's like very straightforward once you realize that that is what is missing.
We talked about this a little bit, this tendency on the last podcast. And my wife, somebody listened to it and said to my wife, oh, I hear you're an obliger with a rebel leaning because we had diagnosed you that way. And she now has thought about it for a year or so since the podcast and really agrees.
Oh, yeah. Well, so here's something that everyone who is an obliger or particularly is married to an obliger or works with an obliger should be aware of, which is this phenomenon of obliger rebellion.
Yes, I've seen it.
Okay, well, let me explain it and then you give your example because it's fascinating. So obliger rebellion is when an obliger meets an expectation and then suddenly they snap and they're like, this I will not do. And it can be small, sort of a little symbolic thing, or it can be huge, like ending a relationship, blowing up a friendship of many years, quitting a job, or just like having sort of a shouting fit where everybody around you is sort of like, where is this coming from? It seems very uncharacteristic. Nobody had any sense that it was coming. Obligers themselves often say that it feels out of character or it feels like an explosion. It's not a controlled burn. It's big. And the thing about obliger rebellion, which it took me a while to understand, is that it's meant to be helpful. It's meant to save obligers from places where they're being exploited or taken advantage of or where expectations are just too high or unrealistic. It's like pulling the emergency ripcord. It gets them out. It ends the situation. But it can be very destructive as it's unfolding. And so it's much better for everybody if you try to get in front of the feelings of deep resentment and burnout that lead to obliger rebellion and try to stop it from actually working its way to the surface by dealing with those feelings before they come to a boil. So how have you seen this in your wife?
Well, I definitely see the obliger part it just describes who she is in many ways. Mm. Her whole life is a doctor.
Yeah.
She's really lived with this ethos of service to other people.
Yeah.
But she doesn't. She lets herself down a lot. You know, I see it. It's painful for her.
Yeah. And as a questioner, you're probably like, if you say this is important to you, like, why aren't you doing it?
I don't get it. You know, like she lives with somebody who's so disciplined on some things. I'm obviously not disciplined about sugar, but the exercise and the meditation, I mean, like, nobody has to get on me about it. I'm just doing it.
But see, and this is why obligers, this is a really unfortunate thing about obligers, they often blame themselves. They're like, I'm lazy, I lack willpower, why can't I do, I'm close to somebody who's doing something so easily, why do I struggle? It's like, hey, there's nothing wrong with you. There are a ton of people exactly like you. This is easy to fix. Build in that outer accountability and you can get what you want.
Well, so a great example of that. It's so nice to hear this. Like, I'm kind of channeling Bianca right now. I'm sure that would be, when she listens to this, that's going to feel very good for her. But as an example, we were on vacation recently, and I was exercising every day, as I do. and I was doing something that I normally don't do, which is I was going to SoulCycle. I mean, I like spin, but SoulCycle sometimes I feel like is a little much, but... But anyway, there was one right nearby, so I was going a lot, and I was enjoying it. And I kind of half-heartedly said to my wife, you know, you should come. And she kind of surprised me by saying yes, but I knew she regretted it immediately, but she had said yes, and so I knew she would come.
Yeah.
And as soon as we walked in there, she was like, oh, my God, I hate this. You know, just because there was so many people in there, she's a little bit – she's shy.
Yeah.
And so during –
It's an intense –
Yes,
if you haven't been to SoulCycle, I've never been, but I've seen it. It's like
it's pretty intense.
It's a lot happening.
Yes, loud music. And, well, all spin classes are kind of have
and
loud
close
music.
Close proximity, people are sweating.
Absolutely.
It's a lot going on.
And in spin and in SoulCycle, there's a whole. I've been spinning for a long time just because it's a good workout, even though I kind of hate it when I'm doing it. But SoulCycle in particular has this whole rah rah soul aspect to it, which I've built a whole career of rebelling against. So I'm sure if any like people who like my book would probably be surprised that I would go to SoulCycle. But anyway, it was convenient. And so I'm in SoulCycle this time with my wife. And the whole time I'm thinking, God, I'm sure she's going through the stages of grief right now, just going to hate me. We walk out. She loved it. She
really?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it and has been going back. And we've been going as a couple.
Ah.
And you know, we've gone. So I think there's something about the class structure that's really important to her.
Well, and you really feel like you're recognized and part of it. It's like you're not just in the back, like doing your thing.
Yes.
Like SoulCycle is like, we're part of this together.
Yes.
It's like a team feeling.
What she doesn't like, if you go to some spin classes or group exercise classes, the instructor will come around to you and kind of get in your face or critique you in some way. I actually like that.
Yeah.
But she hates that
and
will quit. And there's the rebel. So she doesn't want to feel judged. She doesn't want to like getting in her face and like pushing her too hard. She wants to be kind of left alone to do this thing. She likes to be feeling part of the group. And we have a trainer we work with too, who she likes that accountability.
Trainer,
but she doesn't want to be judged.
So that is a very, very important point, which is when it comes to outer accountability, there's tremendous variation among what works for obligers. So one of the variations is exactly the thing you just pointed out. Some obligers only like sort of positive reinforcement. So they want somebody to be like, it's so great. You come home and you're like, I can't believe it. You've exercised 4 times in a row. That is great. Like, you must feel so good. And you're like, yes, somebody's noticing that I'm doing it. I feel like there's accountability there, but it's positive accountability. And so if you're that kind of person, you want to make sure that you set up your accountability structure in a way that it doesn't feel judgy. It doesn't feel negative, because that might just make you drop it altogether. Other obligers, like some obligers, feel very obligated if they pay for something. Like if they pay for an exercise class, they're going to go, because they're like, I have to go because I paid. Some obligers almost feel off the hook if they paid. Kind of like, well, I paid for it. That's like as good as going. I'm like, well, that's not working for you. Somebody said to me, in all seriousness, she's like, well, I was good. I made all these appointments with a trainer, but then I realized if I don't go, he still gets paid and he gets the time back. So she felt obligated not to go. And I was like, this is not working for you. You know what I mean? Like,
what did you advise her to do?
I was like, you need to get another accountability structure. But so I belong to like a high intensity strength training gym. And so you have an appointment with a trainer, and it works really well for people who need accountability. But I said to them, and I really want to try to get them to do this, you should give people the option that if they don't come, you will charge them triple. Don't require that. Say you offer it as an option, because I bet some people would take it, because they know they might skip it if they're just paying for the session. But if they're paying triple for the session, that raises the stakes. And they might opt into that in order to have the accountability.
Absolutely.
An accountability group. This is something a lot of people use. Like, you're trying to write your PhD thesis, you're trying to lose weight, whatever it is, you have a group, and the group is going to hold you accountable. But one thing is, for people who are very introverted, maybe they don't like to go to a group and have a conversation. That makes it sort of less appealing. I have this app, the Better app, where people can join and talk about the 4 tendencies. And one of the things they can do is form an accountability group. And I think it's something that's very attractive to people who are really busy and want the convenience of using an app, but also people who don't really necessarily want to be face-to-face for accountability. They want to have a little bit, they want to do it in a way where it's a little at more of a remove. That feels more comfortable to them.
So rebels.
So rebels, tremendous upside and also some frustrations on their own part and of others. So rebels are extremely in touch with what they want and what they choose. They're very eager to be authentic to themselves. It's easy for them to think unconventionally. They might delight in breaking convention and going out, you know, thinking outside the box. The fact that you're going to resist if somebody asks or tells you to do something, can cause issues. So if you are a rebel or you're dealing with a rebel, the two things that kind of work if you're trying to get that rebel to do something, one is to think about identity, because rebels can do anything they want to do. And so if they think, I choose to be a responsible leader, I choose to be a loving, consistent parent, I choose to be a considerate member of this team, then they can do the things, even the things that feel uncomfortable to them, because it's part of expressing their nature. Mm-hmm. The other thing they can do is think about, and this works if you're communicating with a rebel, is information, consequences, choice. Give the information the rebel needs, tell them the consequences of their action or inaction, and then let them choose how to act. So you might say, well, You know, at the weekly staff meeting, which, you know, you haven't been coming for a while, but what we do at that staff meeting typically is we decide the projects, how we're going to divide up the upcoming projects for the next, you know, couple months. If you go to the meeting, you get to, you know, argue for what you want. If you don't go to the meeting, everybody else takes the interesting projects and you're left with the boring dregs. The meeting's at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays. So come if you want. You know what I mean? And then it's just like, okay, well, you can come or not if you want, but I'm not going to check on you. I'm not going to remind you. It's up to you. But you can't protect or insulate a rebel from the negative consequences of a choice or a failure to choose. And that can be painful. It's like painful to let a rebel child suffer consequences. Sometimes if you're like married to a rebel, those consequences could fall on you.
Yeah.
But that's what works. And rebels over and over. And don't nag and don't remind. The more you nag and remind rebels, the more you ignite the spirit of resistance. Because they might want to do something, but if you tell them to do it, then they're like, well, I'm not going to because you're not the boss of me.
So I'm trying to figure out if my two-year-old is a rebel because he's a rebel or because he's two.
Well, two is pretty young.
Yeah.
Rebel does, many rebels, interestingly, have just spontaneously emailed me to say that they remember the moment in early childhood where they realized that no one could make them do something. Like, so I think it can kick in, your tendency can kick in very early. Two is probably, you're not really, I don't think you have fully evolved consciousness at that point, probably.
Probably, but yep.
And it's even hard, you know, all through high school because they're just not autonomous in the way that adults are. They're not making decisions
right.
The way adults are. So it can be hard to tell. Sometimes it's very easy to tell, but sometimes it's hard to tell.
There's no way in which my son is fully evolved.
Yeah, well, he's two. Right, right. Let's hope. Yeah.
I keep telling him he can have more agency when he stops pooping his pants.
Oh, right. Okay, that's the key thing. Okay, that's the milestone.
But what it does work with him, though, is giving him a choice.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
That really, it's like the magic thing. If we say, all right, do you want to go to bed right now with the consequences? Like, you can either go to bed right now and you'll get 5 stories, or you can not listen to us and you're not going to get any stories, nor will you get your milk.
Well, I think that for a lot of children, that works because they do feel such a lack of agency. And so it gives them a sense of control. So that might not be related to tendency.
Right.
But certainly with rebels, like older rebel or children that you know are rebels, it's very helpful to say like something like, well, you know, if you go outside on a bright sunny day, you could get a really bad sunburn, which is going to really hurt. Your skin can even blister and peel. And then you're stuck inside all day while your friends are outside playing because you've got to recover from your sunburn. So do you feel like wearing a long sleeve T-shirt and a baseball cap, or do you prefer to wear sunscreen lotion? Information, consequences, choice.
Right, right.
And then if the kid's like, I don't want to do it, it's like, okay, see how that goes for you. You know what I mean? And I think sometimes people are like, well, you can't go outside without sunscreen. Yes, you can. You can. You can. And a rebel knows that. You can go outside without sunscreen. It can happen. It is possible. This is what I learned as an upholder from the rebels. I'm like, we're way more free than we think. There's a lot of things you feel like you have to do that actually you don't have to do.
Right. So we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but just talk again about what you think the consequences and potential use are of this framework that you set out. Thank you. I was having a fit.
I think it comes into play in two ways. One is with yourself. You want to manage yourself. So, you know, you want to quit sugar. What's the best way for you to quit sugar? Or I want to write a novel in my free time, and yet I never miss a deadline at work, and yet why am I not working on my novel? Okay, how might I address that? How could I understand what's stopping me or frustrating me? But then it's also other people. So there's managing yourself, and then there's also dealing with other people. So I have a conflict with my coworker who keeps questioning every decision I make. And I'm like, why doesn't he trust my authority? Why doesn't he defer to this is my area. Like, why do I have to keep like fielding these phone calls and emails? I feel like he's attacking me. Oh, maybe he's not attacking me. Maybe this is just his way. Maybe he's a questioner. Maybe he thinks he's adding value to the process. You know, I don't have to be angry about it. I could say to him, you know what? I feel like I'm spending too much time answering your questions. Like, we need to come up with a better way to deal with this. But I don't have to be as unsettled by it. Or let's say you're a doctor and you're trying to get people to take their medication. It's like, why aren't they taking their medication? Right? Why don't people take their medication? Some research suggests that up to 50% of American adults don't take prescription medication for a chronic health condition. And it's not like they're like, I'm convinced that this medicine is worthless. It's like, no, they probably be like, yeah, I probably should take that medicine. So why don't they? I think that the four tendencies gives you a lot of strategies for how you might communicate with such a person more effectively.
So how do you see this going? How do you see greater adoption playing out if it does happen?
You know, I think, I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to get the word out as much as I can. And I've already started, ever since Better Than Before came out, I have started hearing from people who are using it in different ways. And that's super fascinating to me, of course, and how they communicate with people. So I don't really have a grand plan for how to launch this into the world of ideas other than to write a book and hope that a lot of people, I mean, I kind of feel like it's the sort of thing where the proof is in the pudding, where if people read this or hear about it and it resonates with them and they're able to make an important change or have an important insight into themselves or other people, you know, that's what's going to make people think like, yeah, there's really something here.
Final couple minutes, totally selfish request, but
yes.
Like the idea that you're a happiness bully. Like,
yes.
I just want to take advantage of that.
Yeah,
you know,
let
like,
me.
What is that? Like, how could I be happier and how would you bully me into doing that?
Well, what do you feel like is getting in your way? You seem like a pretty happy guy.
No, I am a pretty happy guy. Sugar was and is
so
a big
tell thing. Me, take me through your strategies for how you're gonna approach this.
I'm not going to put anything with sugar in my mouth.
Okay.
That's what I'm going to
okay,
do.
So let me give you some liminal situations.
Yes.
What about bread?
So I actually, my secret plan is no sugar and no flour.
Okay. Well, we need clarity here. You're a questioner, so we need absolute clarity on what is being demanded of you.
Well, because Bianca has not signed on to
Oh,
the
I see.
Part.
Okay.
Yes.
So you need to have a consultation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But what you would ideally do is say,
yes.
No. Now, is that wheat flour? Does that include pasta?
Yes.
Okay. So no flour, no sugar.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What about honey, which many people feel like is a
doesn't,
magical doesn't elixir
make me
of life?
Good. No, it's sugar.
No, it's sugar.
Yes.
Maple sugar is sugar.
Yes.
Ketchup is sugar.
I don't really eat ketchup.
Okay. Ketchup is maple syrup for hamburgers. okay, so you're going to quit sugar. So, and you hope that you're going to do it together.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to buy anything for your household.
Well, we have a kid who eats, we let him have a little bit of sugar. So there's that. That makes
Ooh.
Things difficult.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
So.
But I think really the key for me in this one was, I think. We may talk in 2 weeks and this is all obliterated, but I think the key really is about seeing is being able to finally get that if I do this thing, it's like when I quit doing drugs, you know, like I just
You've gone through it.
I didn't want to have more panic attacks. Like
right.
I just got it. I got it. I had two panic attacks on the air. It was horrible. I get it. I'm not doing that again. I like drugs a lot. I mean, I have an addictive tendency. But I'm not doing it again because there's very compelling reason not to. And every time I have sugar, the entire next day is a waste.
So, and I'm just beckoning you from the far shore saying, if you never have it, you don't want it. You will not care. It will not bother you. You will not be filled with regret.
It's
you
the
more you
yes.
don't have it,
yeah.
the easier it is. I think sometimes people feel like, well, if I don't have something, my desire for it is going to build and build and build, and it's going to overwhelm me, and I'm just going to have this kind of crash. Now, this gets into the whole abstainer moderator thing, which I talk about in Better Than Before, because some people are better off having a little bit. They're better off having something sometimes. If you're an abstainer, if you feel like it's easier to have none, and clearly you're somebody who
Definitely.
Feels like it's easier to have none, you're not going to have one square of fine chocolate a day. It's like a whole sleeve of Oreos or none, which is exactly the way I am. The longer you go without it, the less you want it. It gets easier, not harder. That's really has been my experience.
I believe that. Again, I'm just going to revert to my Buddhist thing again. But it's about kind of feeding patterns of thought. So I can see how somebody who's a moderator, like actually the way to tamp down on the voice in your head talking about sugar all the time would be to just give yourself that one thing.
Right.
Yeah, that one square of chocolate a day. It like shuts everything down.
Yeah.
But for me, knowing that the square is an option just ramps everything up.
Yes.
Oh,
one square, two squares, three squares.
Exactly.
It's raining. It's my birthday. After the day I've had, I should have more. You only live once. Life's too short not to have a bar of chocolate.
Exactly.
I mean, oh, gosh. Yeah. One of the things I would say is go deep into your questioner side, which is I'm sure you've read all the stuff about sugar and how it's bad for you. Have you read The Case Against Sugar by Gary Tobbs?
I am aware of it. I don't need, I've heard enough.
No. I think you should read it.
Okay.
Because I think as a questioner, it's really going to clarify.
Interesting.
It's going to give you those justifications that are going to strengthen you, that are going to make you all like feel more purposeful about it.
Right.
And also, and you could say to your wife, I need you to help me do this. I need, because if you need her
tapping into her obliger tendency.
Yes.
Okay.
I need you to set me the good example. If I see you indulging, I'm going to feel like I can indulge. I need you to do this with me. I need you to be my example. That's going to help her. One of the mottos for obligers is you can count on me, and I'm counting on you to count on me. So she's counting on you to count on her.
Yeah.
And by seeing her example, you're going to be like, well, like this is clearly something we can do.
What are the, when you're bullying people about happiness, what are the other things that you hone in on, just like at a cocktail party?
Oh my gosh, I can really sort of be a jerk. I mean, I talked to this woman, oh my gosh, I'm haunted by it. And she was like, my dream one day is to open up a flower shop. And she was in dental school. Dental school is a very specific thing. So I'm like, well, why are you in dental school? And she's explaining to me, well, she likes the hours. She's always been good at science. She likes working with people, all this. But then one day she was going to like open up the flower shop. This was her dream. This was something that was totally with it. I mean, I'm not going to get into the whole details of her life, but that's something that she could have done right now. And I was just like, why are you not opening up your flower shop right now? Like, why is that the impossible dream? You could do that. Why are you in dental school? I mean, that's hard. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of money. It's
I'm
a lot of
effort.
This yeah. And I mean, I was like, really, like, to the point where I wanted to jump. It was like at a ladies' luncheon. I wanted to leap over the table, knock over the water glasses with my heels, and shake her and be like, you've got to start the flower shop. You know what I mean? It's just like, why would you not? I don't know. It just seemed like she didn't have a vision of why she was doing. I mean, and it wasn't like one thing was easy and one thing was hard. They were both hard. They're both very, very hard. And the dental school thing was like, that's like a 15-year plan. You know, she was really locking herself in. And then once you've got a dental school and you're a dentist, it's like, how can you be like, oh, 2 years later? I mean, I did this with law school, right? Went through law school, clerked for 2 years, and then quit and became a writer. For a lot of people, that would be really hard because they're like, after all the time and energy and money that I've poured into this, how can I turn my back on it? It's the problem of sunk costs. It's hard to do that, you know? And the more you go into something where you're sinking a lot of investment into a certain fate, it becomes harder and harder to switch.
Okay, last question. This is one area where I actually do think maybe you could bully me in some positive ways about happiness. Time management. I would guess what I would say if there was one thing that is kind of a drag on my happiness is like figuring I have so much to do and then figuring out how to do it all in a way that doesn't drive me absolutely bonkers. And it can make me irritable. Like I was a little irritable with my wife this morning. Not words were not exchanged, but I just like wasn't in the mood to talk to her because I had so much weighing on me.
Well, I mean, from what I know about you is I just think you have a lot in your day. Like your day is really planned for you to be at top efficiency at every moment.
Yes.
And so I think part of the problem, it's not that you're not efficient. It's just that you have extremely high expectations of what you can do with your time. Like you meditate for 2 hours a day. Well, that's 2 hours a day of awake time right off the table, you know, and you have a lot. You have many, many responsibilities. So I'm not sure your problem is efficiency. It's more like you have a problem of ambition. You really want to do a lot of things. So you could sit down and say, like, well, is something not important to me that I'm doing? And so I could lighten my load that way. Or maybe just sort of say, look, I don't want to let anything go. I want to do everything. And sometimes it's just going to make me feel like I'm sort of maybe barely hanging on. Or like I go through periods where I'm like only preparing for the next day. Like there's nothing that I'm doing that isn't for tomorrow. I'm doing this blog post for tomorrow. I'm preparing this podcast episode for tomorrow. You know, everything, I'm just looking at my schedule for tomorrow because I don't have the flexibility to look outward. I couldn't live like that all the time, but you just have a lot of things you want to fit into your day.
It's really interesting. So my wife and I did a thing when I was freaking out about this, I don't know, like 18 months ago, where we kind of put everything that I was working on index cards and threw them down the table. And there was nothing, there was like literally nothing either of us could agree that
wasn't valuable.
We had to do them all. And I think I didn't actually say this to myself, but what you just articulated is probably exactly right, which is I think I have to just come to terms with the fact that I'm going to do all these things. sometimes I'm going to be unhappy.
Right. Sometimes it's going to make you feel like you're just trying to cram too much in. But also, you're in the rush hour of life. You know, you're like kind of right in your career. You've got a family. You've got a day job. You've got a side hustle. You've got a lot going on. And that's just where you are. It's the season of life. And so I don't think that there's an efficiency trick that would help. It's just that you want to cram a lot into your day. And there's a satisfaction to that, too. You know, that's what you want. That's what you choose. And so I think there's a comfort that comes from just saying there's no waste there. There's nothing that you're doing out of just sheer obligation or out of inertia or habit. It's all valuable to you.
Yes, that's true.
So that's very fortunate. There's something to be grateful
for
that.
High class problem.
Yeah.
No question about it. I'm very grateful for it. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's probably why you're meditating 2 hours a day. It's like, what is it? If you're feeling, if you're feeling calm, meditate for X time. If you're feeling rushed, meditate for what's the saying?
The expression is, everybody should meditate for 20 minutes a day. And if you don't have 20 minutes, you should do 40 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. So if you're meditating for 2 hours, that suggests a pretty heavy load.
Yeah. No, and I need it. You know, like I need it. Plus also the whole 2 hour a day thing is also kind of an experiment and something I'll write about. And we don't have time for this.
But it's not 2 hours at once.
No, definitely not.
Right.
No. Before you go, just give us a whole rundown of where people can find assets and information and all the stuff if they want to learn more about you.
Okay, so I have a website called GretchenRubin.com. You know, spoiler alert. and I post there almost every day about my adventures and happiness and good habits on the four tendencies. And there's tons of resources there, too, if you want, like, one-pagers on how to use the four tendencies or discussion guides for the book and all sorts of things. Then I also have a podcast that I do with my sister called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. And we talk about the four tendencies there a lot, but also just everything related to happier. You were one of our first guests.
I was definitely not the first guest, but I was there once and your mom was in it. We were in like a little shipping container recording.
We now have much nicer studios.
Okay, gotcha. But
yeah, you were in the old black hole studio. Yes.
I got a little claustrophobic in there.
Yeah, I remember that because it was it has like a very low ceiling.
But your mother calmed me down. She was so calm.
Yeah.
I was like, all right.
Yeah, she's a calm person. So that's Happier with Gretchen Rubin. And then I have that app that I mentioned, which is a place where you can go if you want to have conversations with people or like you're a parent who's struggling with an issue with a child or you're in healthcare and you want to talk about with other healthcare people how to use it. And you can have the accountability groups. So there's all kinds of accountability groups for anything you could think of, or you can start your own. And that's the Better app. And it's betterapp.us if you're on a desktop or if you're in the App Store, you just search for Better Gretchen Rubin and you'll find it. And then, of course, the book is like where I lay this whole thing out very systematically about how you think about the four tendencies. Oh, and I'm on Instagram and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter under the name Gretchen Rubin.
You know, I was looking at Instagram today and I was realizing I don't follow you. I need to start following you.
You should. I'll follow you.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you. Great job.
Thank you. It's so fun to talk to you. Thanks
Always.
For having me again.
Always.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produced this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. and you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.